have to talk about it. I got to say it again here.
So far. Alright. Thanks for coming out. This is a panel conversation on community farms, essentially as a solution to everything, but particularly the climate that we find ourselves in right now. And so we'll start with a brief introduction from myself and our three panel members. My name is Eric. I'm from San Diego in Southern California. Hello, welcome, friends. I think what motivates me is having a healthy life, and having a healthy life means having a healthy environment, and the environment that's been kind of handed to us by our culture doesn't seem to be one of health and wellness. So what really inspires me is creating a beautiful life for myself and our friends. And that's a lot of what drives me, and I'll share a little bit more throughout the conversation about what I've been working on and coming to this conclusion of, hey, we should begin to organize ourselves, and a farm model is a really good way to do so. So here is Avery.
Hi, my name is Avery Hardy. I'm excited to talk about the things that excite me the most, mostly how farming can reverse climate change. My background is relevant to these topics. I've been involved in, been privileged to be involved in a lot of different dimensions of looking at these questions. I studied forestry and natural resources at UC Berkeley, and as well as sustainable environmental design and city regional planning, and have been fortunate to work with a number of organizations, nonprofits that work in that realm, in particular at the nexus of land stewardship and climate change mitigation. I'm also from this area and grew up with these oaks, and am really grateful to be out here talking about how we can take care of this landscape and produce yields for ourselves in ways that allow us to be efficient and impactful parts of our ecosystems, reversing the damage that has been done to them.
Hello everyone, my name is Derek Burrows. I'm a freelance investigative journalist, author, activist, free human from Houston, Texas. I think I got on this panel. It's interesting because I think everyone submitted different ideas for proposals, and then it kind of all got brought together on this, so it's cool because we're coming from different angles for a lot of the same issues. As far as this particular topic, talking about farming and community gardening, that's been an essential part of what I do back in Houston. I've been involved with a community I started called the Houston Freethinkers since 2010 up until this point. And I live in a community space called the Freethinker House, where we have a big community garden. We grow a lot of our own food there. We've got lots of fruit trees, and we'll have weekly community gardening events. And for years I volunteered at one of Houston's biggest urban farms that was in one of Houston's poorest parts of town called the Last Organic Outpost, just working and learning permaculture, helioculture, aquaponics, all kinds of different things. And I also started a organic gardening business, just helping build simple square foot gardens for people who didn't have the time or, you know, the knowledge to do so. And I did that, I'm proud to say, without getting the business license or asking for permission, and also accepted alternative currencies sort of as my main business model. So people who, you know, just want to build a garden, to me there's no reason anybody should be involved in that. So also as a community organizer and related to localization of food production and decentralization in general, I promote a concept that I hope I get more time to talk about throughout this that I call Freedom Cells. Freedom Cells are small, decentralized, localized groups of 7 to 10 people organizing for mutual benefit, mutual aid. And really it's a limitless concept, but we've definitely applied it towards community gardening and urban farming. So you can check that out at freedomcells.org if you're interested in finding more about that. And I'm happy to be here. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, this is actually just listening to how incredible it is, and we have never met, and our worlds are so connected in terms of what we're doing. My name is Dr. Life, many my AKA Brian Neal Hewlett, but everyone calls me Dr. Life. I am the owner and founder of the Foundation and Ministry of Life, and Life stands for Limitless Ideas and Free Environments, which is what we're about today, trying to help people get into a space of consciousness and regenerativeness and regenerative technologies and sustainability. And so that's kind of what I do. I'm a social scientist, as a psychologist and a sociologist, and so I am about social regenerative systems and helping us develop a consciousness that will move us from just leaving no trace to actually creating situations and systems that will regenerate and develop human sustainability.
Awesome, thank you. Welcome, new friends. We just did some brief introductions on our talk about community farming as a solution to climate change. And so I think a good format is we'll allow each of you to speak on something that's a little bit closest to your relevance and expertise, and try to weave a conversation within that. And then if like Avery takes on the bulk of talking about current climate and addressing where we're at, then we'll give time to Derek and Dr. Life as well for a little bit of an add-on, and we can kind of cycle our way through the conversation that way. And so here's what I'm thinking we'll do. We'll talk about current state of affairs, right? What's our current climate? We'll spend a minute talking about what's our ideal environment, like what kind of habitat would we really enjoy for ourselves. I'd love to touch on the power of organization and kind of the purpose of organization and what that might afford to us, including the efficacy, and then get into some nuts and bolts of how we might utilize corporate models to achieve all of that in a really efficient way. So to start with current climate, who's aware of current state of affairs a little bit? Who kind of wishes sometimes they'd have their head in the sand? Yeah, it's a little bit daunting out there. We had a great talk yesterday that I got to listen in on that was kind of part one of this discussion, which was addressing climate, right? And designing for climate. And we were talking a lot about, you would call it environmental climate, right? Like the biome and the weather and all these super things, kind of 50,000 square foot level, you know, climate aspects. But there's also social climate. You know, there's the climate within our towns, our villages, our households. So really, when we talk about creating, you know, healthy climate for ourselves or healthy environment for ourselves, there's a whole spectrum. So feel free to, you know, including our current presidents. You know, that's part of our climate. So let's, Avery, you can start and, you know, kind of go whole picture, and then we can get a little bit of that on. But let's address what our current climatic conditions are.
Yeah, that's a big question. I try and avoid talking so much these days about like the details of everything that is, you know, dysfunctional at a global ecological level, because I think at this point most of us know problems in the water cycle with, you know, extreme drought, desertification, and also changes in the frequency and intensity of rainfall, which have catastrophic impacts on ecosystems. Super high concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and of course the fact that our species triggered a mass extinction. there's a lot to work
y'all
with.
Catch that? When did that happen?
That's a great question. So I'll throw out a jargon word here, the Anthropocene. Can you raise your hand if you've heard that term before, the Anthropocene? Yeah. So starting roughly around the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, our species actually created a geologic impact, a climatic impact that changed us out of one geologic era, the Holocene, and marked the beginning of a new one, the Anthropocene, age of man, basically. So not only did we create a new geologic era, but we've also triggered a new mass extinction. So that, I think, is important to note alongside, you know, carbon concentrations in the atmosphere and some of the other dimensions of climate change related to greenhouse gases and fossil fuels. So rather than maybe just talking about the details of everything that I would like to offer a framing that for me was really transformative, which was to think of the crisis, the greenhouse gas crisis, as not just a problem of too much carbon in the atmosphere, but also too little in the places where we need it, because carbon is, of course, the building block of soil fertility and of all biology. So the issue is not just exclusively that we have too much, it's also that, you know, our agricultural practices, our land use practices have contributed, you know, incredibly problematically to loss of topsoil and loss of soil fertility. So there are a lot of consequences to that. And what I'm really excited about on the solutions front is the opportunity for us to shift the concentration of carbon in the atmosphere and store it long-term in the soil in ways that not just mitigate the issues we have with greenhouse gas concentration, but that also assist in the recovery of soil fertility. And that can have impacts on not just our agricultural ecosystems, but also on, you know, natural landscapes such as this. So, mostly when people talk about those practices, they use the phrase carbon farming, which is a newer term that sometimes is used more narrowly to talk about very particular practices. But I use that term to just talk about any practice which is regeneratively storing carbon in the atmosphere long term in this soil bank, where, you know, a molecule of carbon won't, an atom of carbon won't stay forever, but it can stay for very long periods of time. You know, we talk about the residency time of a single, you know, piece of carbon stored long term in the soil is give or take, you know, somewhere in the range of 35 years before it is recycled back into the atmosphere. So there's a lot of potential around those practices to draw down carbon, so to speak, and store it long term in the soil. Let's see, any other dimensions of that that
Well, she did an excellent job for really kind of describing the picture, and I think, like you said, everybody, we already sort of are aware of the circumstances, and if not, I mean, it's not that hard to find information. The only thing I really want to emphasize is, you know, the solutions like she's talking about you know, catching carbon and restoring it in the soil, things like that. I just want to emphasize the need for community-driven action, because, you know, especially at transformational festivals and think experiences, gatherings like this, we try to assume that we're coming into a more conscious environment, and, you know, there's like recycling and composting and all these sort of things, and everybody's participating in it. But it's still, you know, it's up to you to participate in that, right? And it also depends on what you do when you leave here, because if once we leave these gates and this campground, if we go to, you know, polluting and doing whatever else, or being wasteful and just not changing our personal habits, then really nothing changed. We came out here, we had a bunch of good conversations, we had some fun, but there's no, you know, long-term change. And the reason I emphasize community-driven action, because I think historically and empirically we can see that communities know best how to take care of their environments and what's going on. And I am an anarchist and I don't believe in state centralized solutions. I call my work holistic anarchism, and it focuses on looking at the whole picture, including the environment, looking at every area of our life. And it asks us to emphasize, instead of just noticing the problem and then pointing your fingers at the people and the institutions, the corporations you hold responsible, but turning the finger around and asking, well, how am I contributing to this? How much waste am I producing every day? And seeing, you know, through your personal habits in your daily life, and then also on a communal level, how you can reduce that impact. And one of the reasons I really emphasize that is because the state solutions are not things that I think are gonna help in the long term. They're either, some would say, not enough, but also, how many people here are familiar with the term geoengineering? So geoengineering is one state solution that they are developing, and it's something that I've been studying and following for, you know, for quite some time now. And the studies have been increasing. Right now they're doing computer and mathematics studies to see how they think, you know, theoretically this would play out. And geoengineering is really a catch-all term for all kinds of different ways to try to mitigate climate change. But some of the studies that have focused on what is known as SRM, or solar radiation management, involves spraying different aerosols out of planes to try to reflect sunlight to combat climate change and slow things down. And many of these studies, I mean, I can send you links and links to all these studies, have predicted a loss of blue skies. In the long term, they predicted that maybe we help one area of the world, but then we create drought in a whole other. You know, loss of food supply in some of the poorest parts of the world, because who's going to use this technology? The people who have it, the richest nations, you know, and who gets to decide who uses it? And, you know, and also there's just a whole bunch of different concerns. So my suggestion would be research geoengineering if you've never heard about it, specifically solar radiation management, and just focus on what you can do as an individual, you know, and having these conversations and going back to your communities and emphasizing how we can create these solutions, because I just personally, I don't have much faith in them coming from top-down structures.
Hi there. I'm gonna be a little more gloom and doom here, because they switched to solutions a little bit, and I have a very specific process that I teach my students, and I never depart from it. So let's first actually talk about defining the problem. And in sociology or social science, we have clearly three different realms of problems. Problems and issues. And we have a macro realm, which is our world. If we talk about our world realm, right, we have a meso realm, which we have to talk about, like our communities, and then we have a micro realm, which is talking about us, okay, individuals. And all of those are connected, very clearly connected. And the social climate, in terms of non-regenerative, non-sustainable, earth-damaging climate, is very clear on all three of those aspects. Yes, three. That includes you too, okay? So first, if we talk about the world situation and the climate of the world, we have to talk about our world systems, and we have a theory that we talk about, a theoretical space in social science called world systems theory, that talks about, you've heard third world countries, second world countries, first world countries, right? Those first world countries are countries like, guess what? The United States and Britain and all of those countries that are wealthy and that are in control of the world's resources, even though they don't have them and the resources are not positioned in those nation states, but they control those resources. And how do they control those resources? They control those resources through those middle or this meso states, or those second world nations, which they manipulate to rape, basically, and pillage first, third world nations, to extract as much of the resources from those nations that they can, so that they can give something in return to those second world nations, in hopes that they will become a first world nation, right? And then they can control those resources for simply nothing else but profit. All right, so that's a problem on the world systems. We cannot talk about regeneration or sustainability if the focus of the first world nations is profit and power. All right? Yes, there we go. Trade wars with China, all these things. You can see what's happening right now. So that climate shows you how nations are willing to forego safety of the people in order to actually gain a higher presence in that world system. China, for instance, is one of the states that basically through their communist situation said, we are going to actually have to lose humans and cull our population through our environmental destruction in order to actually garner resources to become a more first world nation. That's what their plan has been. Their plan has been in terms of moving through the system, and they have done it. They're doing it pretty darn well, and the people have bought into that. So the second level is our communities, right? Our communities are buying into the structural situations, for instance, like how to buy food. Did anybody realize, well, we should, who doesn't know that Amazon bought Whole Foods? Right, okay. Amazon bought Whole Foods, and it's not just Amazon. If we think about other situations that are happening in our communities where these conglomerates, national, international companies are moving in right next to mom and pop shops that used to be our neighbors, the coffee shop, the grocery stores, the farming that came, that used local farming goods, right? And moving in and lowering their prices as low as they can to drive people into their shops and then drive those shops out of business. Amazon actually gets subsidies from your city to do exactly that. They will come in, get grants from the money that you paid in your taxes to actually subsidize their distribution centers, right? And say, yeah, we're bringing jobs, ha ha. But at the same time, they're taking that money and starting a situation where people will order their food and order everything from Amazon instead of going down the street to get salt and sugar, or even next door to the neighbor to get it. All right? So we as a community actually buy into that and actually support that, which is non-regenerative, non-sustainable, and clearly community damaging. Right? The third level is us, individual, right? Anyone who actually buys from Amazon instead of buying or connecting with a local person to get your resources and your needs are actually feeding the non-regenerative, the non-sustainable, and the community self-damaging system, right? We don't look at what's happening in our world. We flew into LA to meet up with Cole, who lives there, and we went to shop for this, and he took us to the local store, and Nathan was like, what? There is not one bit of organic local food in this place. What is going on, right? So we obviously are, as individuals, right, flowing through the system and maintaining the system by actually participating in it. We have a very clear theory in social science that talks about the fact that status characteristics is what it's called, that as we create status hierarchies, everyone on the levels, on each different levels, works to maintain the status hierarchy. And it's dependent. That is what drives, makes something, the status hierarchy thrive, is because we know that every single level will maintain it. And so we have to break out of that in order to talk about creating property spaces, which I'll talk about in a minute as we go into solutions, that are at all three of those levels. So we'll get back to you.
Yeah, we'll take a quick question.
So my thoughts on this is,
it's a question.
So do you think that with Whole Foods selling out to Amazon, that that's actually maybe supporting some of the organic communities because we're selling more organic food to people, or?
No.
If you can keep it real brief, I'd like to stay on track, but I'll honor the question.
Yeah, my answer is no. because the control and the profit and all of the resources that come out of that don't go back to those farmers.
Thanks for the question. We can touch in on that later. Okay, thank you, lovely panelists, for such a great introduction to our current climate and state of affairs. Hello and welcome to people who are just walking in. We're talking about chair over here. Squeeze for one more. So we've established a touch of an understanding about our current climate, and so now it's like, well, what are we doing here? Right? What is the life of our choosing? Would we like to just be another cog in the wheel? Would we like to be, you know, a hamster on the wheel? What is our life choosing? Are we choosing a better life for ourselves? Who thinks about like the ways that they'd like to live in the world, right? Okay, so we're gonna do like a 1 minute team visioning, exercise. Who would like to eat really healthy food, right? You know, who would like to see some of that food coming from like their garden or like the farm across the street? Who would like to know the person growing their food? Who would like to live in a lovely, if it's less work, we can just keep our hands up. It could be more efficient. Who would like to live in a really healthy home? Right? Who would like to live in a place for like a long time and never have to be forced out of that place because the rent went up or something weird like that? A home of naturally built materials with a beautiful kitchen. Who would like to live in listen to great live music on a regular basis? Right? To have a lifestyle, something that they're engaged in, a right livelihood for work, where they're actually contributing to their local community and people they know and the world around them, right? So this is something that we know, right? So we've established the climate. We don't need to spend too much time on like, oh yeah, like I'm gonna have like, you know, the white picket fence or the shutter. Like we can still have white picket fence, right? Or golden retrievers if we so choose. But like we have a sense for the life we'd like to do. So it's like, okay, how can we be efficient in doing that? That's really the question, right? And we covered, you know, aspects of our climate, the ecological aspects, the economic aspects, the social aspects, the food system aspects, the housing aspects, and even like media we didn't really touch on, even though we have a journalist on the panel. So it's like, how can we meet all those needs of ours in the most efficient way possible? That's really the stick, you know, or the gist of the matter, right? And so that's what I'd like to spend the time that we have talking about. What time is it? Who's got the time? 2:00. So we got a whole hour. We'll leave a little bit at the end. So I think the important aspect to touch on might be the power of organization and how if we choose to try to do all of this by ourselves, we're probably not gonna get very far. It's like the scale of the solution required is bigger than just what we're gonna do, you know, by ourselves. And so perhaps Derek, you could talk a little bit about the power of community, the power of collaboration, the power of organization.
Absolutely. So I mentioned a little bit earlier in my introduction that I worked with an activist community called the Houston Freethinkers and have been doing so for about the last 8 years. And the sort of model that we took just spontaneously was to remain decentralized. You know, we'd have regular monthly meetings where whoever showed up, whoever was interested would show up, and if you're there, then you're a Houston Freethinker. And people would say, hey, this is what I'm concerned about. We'd go around and we'd kind of get an understanding of where people are at, what brought them there, and see what common goals we can focus on for the upcoming month. So we would pick a topic and we'd go out and pass flyers about that, or hold a documentary screening about it, or work, do a benefit show to raise awareness about it. And a lot of that centered around community gardening, bringing awareness to urban farming in Houston, to, you know, what is known as food deserts. Houston's got more than a handful of them. And a lot of that action oriented around a couple different community farms, particularly one known as the Last Organic Outpost, which was just, I mean, such an oasis and a beautiful place to see. It's kind of transformed now. It's still it's still a community center, but it's not as much a big giant farm as it was before. But it's essentially just about 2 or 3 acres that was just a cement block. It used to be this old warehouse that was just abandoned, and it was transformed over time. People brought dirt, like literally this oasis. You walk in and see this food everywhere, and you have no idea that you're standing on top of 6 inches of soil on top of concrete, you know. And they did this, like, papaya trees, like all kinds, you know, all kinds of moringa, like all kinds of grapefruit, and we would have weekly gardening events there. One thing I've learned that I can suggest that is, if you organize an event and you bring music and food, people will be there. And, you know, and also, like, so we would have, like, Sundays, like gardening days, so this is kind of more of a laid back thing, right? So we have all kinds of events. Maybe some people aren't going to be the ones out on the street holding a sign or protesting, right? But they're down to come out for a day at the garden. And so you meet different kinds of people through different types of action. And the gardening days would be more chill. We'd tell people, come out, hey, we're going to bring some food, and we're all just going to spend a few hours doing garden work. We had our own plot there for years where we could plant everything we wanted, and we could also take from the other parts of the garden just for volunteering. And that also went to go to local farmers markets, and they did lots of programs with school children that they would bring there and kind of educate them on that. So we tried to regularly do that and then bring musicians there, because eventually they built a stage there, so they had like a cob oven kitchen that was made from cob. If anybody ever played with cob at all, it's very fun stuff. Yeah, so we had like a cob oven there that looked like a garlic clove, and we'd make pizzas and do music and just turn the garden into a community center that people wanted to be at. And it became just this awesome hub for all kinds of activities and action and, you know, different things. And one other idea that I'm really excited about, we haven't got to do it this year because I've been on the road a lot, but we've done it 2 times in Houston now, and I would love for you guys to take this idea and to adapt it to where you're from. But it's what we call the garden crawl. So in Houston, there's a huge biking community, and, you know, everybody's heard of like pub crawls, bar crawls, right? People just walking from one bar to the next or whatever. And there was this thing in Houston called Counter Crawl that was focused on showing people, like, basically we would meet downtown at noon for a bike ride, and there would be 4 or 5 stops, and each stop would be, there would be a musical element, there would be an art element, there would be an interactive element, and some food. And so we'd hang out at each spot for an hour or so and then ride bikes around the city. And so you got to see all these different parts of the city and meet great people. So I went there a couple times, and it was just such a transformative experience. I wanted to take that idea and the whole idea of crawling but with bikes and apply it to gardens. So we took the same concept. We would meet downtown at like 12:30, wait for people to show up, and I just contacted local community gardens. I'm in a big city, Houston, so we have an abundance of them. You know, there's, I can pick from different sides of town and find, you know, several to choose from. So we picked about 4 or 5 gardens and started in the afternoon, and we would just ride to each one. We let them know, hey, we're going to be showing up with a crew of people on bikes. We're going to be showing up for about an hour and a half to volunteer. They would present, like, hey, this is what we do here, this is what we specialize in, and kind of do a little workshop. And then we'd get back on the bikes and like ride, and we did 4 different gardens each day. And we did that 2 different times last year, and very successful. Brought, you know, all kinds of different people who are interested in biking, people who are interested in community gardens, and maybe some people just coming because they're curious. And we had music at each stop as well, like some acoustic acts just performing and things like that. So I think that those things, while they seem very simple, they're great ways to bring people together, because, as you know, we've heard emphasized already, it's going to take more than just us as individuals. Like, the problem's much further than that, and it's also bigger than just one single community as well. I do think we need to get thinking down to the neighborhood level. I like to think of this idea about neighborhood power, neighborhood secession, seceding from the systems that don't serve us, including the unsustainable and very weak food distribution and food production system. Because I'm from Houston, we had a hurricane this last year. You guys might have heard about it on the news, and it destroyed the town, as happens from time to time. And within like a couple hours, once we knew this hurricane was about to hit, all the grocery stores are emptied out, all the gas is emptied out, everybody's trying to get out of town. It's a disaster, right? And if you haven't prepared for it, then like, you're screwed pretty much. And you better hope you have some nice neighbors, you got some friends to leave on, which is where my concept of freedom cells comes in, having that core group to lean on and to work on or work with. But to me, that emphasizes why we need local food production, because we need like 100 urban farms around Houston. Like, we need just, you know, every neighborhood to have that core farm that they can go work with and volunteer at. Because if we're facing any sort of emergency situation, you know, you can think of the most thing from zombie apocalypse to economic collapse to whatever you want to think about, right? the same thing's going to happen. The stores are going to empty out in hours, if not minutes. Supplies are going to be gone very quickly when people start freaking out. And, you know, governmental systems break down, things like that. And if you don't even have a couple of days worth of backup supply of food, and I'm not trying to preach doom and gloom, it's more about preparation as a community. My grandmother has a farm in Kentucky. She's grown up on farms her entire life and instilled a lot of the ideas of preparation for me. All of our ancestors prepared for the winter so that we could be here, you know. Now we think of it in this sort of like, oh, doomsday prepper kind of thing, but it's just smart behavior, you know. Every week my grandma's going to the farm, clipping some veggies, taking it inside, pulling out her pressure canner, and canning a bunch of veggies and taking it down their cellar. And that's what she's done every week of her life growing up. And we've given up a lot of those skills. So I think we need to get back down to the neighborhood level, the communal level, start organizing. I mentioned freedom cells. I don't want to spend too much time hogging the mic, but I do want to mention that again. The idea is groups of 7 to 10 people coming together, and there's reasons for that number. There's different research that, you know, says about that range, 7 to 8 or so, we seem to have, I don't want to say ideal, but it works better than when you have too little people. You can't really get bigger things done if there's too many. You know, people say there's too many chiefs, right? There's too many things going on. So the idea is to have these core groups. Start with whoever's in your community. You already got a core group of people. You don't have to wait to get 7. Start with the 2 or 3 of you and figure out what are your goals, okay? Tonight we're talking about farming and food production, but it could also be like, hey, I'd like to be more economically free. Let's invest in alternative currencies. Hey, I'd like to stop supporting the mainstream corporate media. Let's look and support alternative media. All these different areas, right? Look at the problem that you see and pull yourself from that. The freedom cell is your core group, your group to lean on and to start this. But the long-term goal is that we have these central groups, and after those get established, each group member would then turn around and start a secondary cell. So then you end up with 7 to 10 groups of 7 to 10 people spread across one area. You've got 70 to 100 people, and as this is spreading, you know, around the country, around the world, you end up with this larger network, a parallel network, where as we travel, we can say, check out freedomcells.org and go to our map and say, oh, look, here's that community farm we connected to. So the freedom cells create a parallel network for food production, for trading, for entrepreneurship, and all kinds of things. It's already built at freedomcells.org, at CELLS.org. It's a social network. I don't really like to call it that because it's not about posting your food or cats or, you know, what you're doing that day. It's literally for you to go on there, create a profile. You can put your skills, your interests, and you can search by skills and interests and search on the map, and it'll show you people who have signed up within 5 miles, 10 miles, 50 miles, people who've created cells near you. And it's created for the purpose of meeting digitally, but to create these real world groups. And I think that is one of the tools that can help us get there.
Awesome. Environment of freedom, that's what he's talking about, and it's the same thing that we're talking about at the Foundation of Life. And we are definitely clearly on the same vein of what he's talking about, is starting at the self level and then moving to the community level and then moving to the world level. So, you know, I would have everyone in here put up their hand and say and repeat after me, I will become my personal farmer. Every single person, put your hand up and say, I will become my personal farmer. I will work to produce enough food to sustain myself. Okay, so if we start there, no matter where you are, if you are renting a house, if you are renting a apartment, if you are living in a lot because you are living in a tent, right? You should start growing your own food. Yes, it takes a while. I started last year and I figured out that there's this little thing called mites that I have to deal with that was terrible. And they overcame me, but you know, I'm working on it. The point is, we need to actually go back to, like he said, what our grandmothers and grandfathers did every single day is produce our own food. So if we start there and we start producing our own food, and we become a personal farmer, change our lawns into farms, food producing spaces, change our backyards into food producing spaces, change our lots, empty lots, into food producing spaces. The second thing we do once we start doing that and working towards that is we help our other neighbors become farmers. Stick your hand up in the air. I will help my neighbors become farmers, personal farmers.
I will help my neighbors become personal farmers.
Bingo. So at that point, we are actually creating relationships or freedom cells, as you're arguing, right? Which are naturally occurring because you are one, hanging out with your neighbors and actually getting to know them again, it's astonishing to me that people do not know the person who lives next to them, or that when you try to know them, they act like you're actually out of your cotton picking mind. And I'm like, hello, you live next to me, right? So we need to actually utilize things like farming, right, like in this situation, to create relationships with the neighbors. Because I grew up in a very, very poor neighborhood where there was not much resources in South Philadelphia. But the one thing we did have as resources was each other, and we took care of each other, right? Crime that would happen in our neighborhood was usually somebody else coming into our neighborhood to inflict something upon someone else, right? And we need to at least get back to that, that everyone knows what's going on and everyone is helping each other. So once we've got these freedom cells of farmers happening, then take that freedom cell of farmers and move to your local community governance organization, which would be your community, what are those little organizations, urban development groups or city councils or your community councils, right? And actually take yourself as a block of farmers and go to those meetings and demand resources from your community to support your farming. All right, water, like Denver actually, I love them. They actually, at one point a couple of years ago, it was illegal to actually harvest water, rainwater, because all of the water was to the Colorado damming companies or whatever that was shoving that water to Las Vegas. And the people said, finally got smart. Aurora the same way. Said, wait a minute, rainwater is coming into my property. It's running into rivers, which is going through my property, so I should be able to use that water. And then they demanded that be changed, and it was. And as a political block of farmers, you will have power, which is the other thing we're talking about. Then once you have political block of power in your community, you have meetups with those other political blocks in their communities, right? And you have a city and state and federal block that naturally will grow. And that's individually what we can actually do, organize in a very effective way to make sure we have good food, good water, clean air, right? All those things that are part of our regenerative process. I'll stop there at this one, but of course, we have more to go up the ladder until we get to the world. And we have solutions, community solutions that we'll talk about next, and some world solutions in the next round.
I just wanted to piggyback off of all of that great inspiration, since I'm personally very stoked about the common denominators of radical thought and the trend in our mutual interest in bringing a decolonial, radical anarchist framing to this conversation, and contribute a piece also for some food for thought around our relationship with the land and the obligation that I feel we all have to really step into self-educating on colonization and on the overarching, intersecting. You may hear the word intersect. Can you give a thumbs up if you've heard the word intersectional in this context about, yeah, cool. Yeah, I think an intersectional framing is actually really important to the conversation about regenerative living and climate change mitigation. And a piece of that that's so relevant to us being here is that we're in an ecosystem that was historically managed by the Chumash people for incredible drawdown of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. We're on land, on a sacred site in particular here at Live Oak, you know, that was taken via genocide from the indigenous stewards of this land, the Chumash people. And I think it's important, you know, not just to press that we're on stolen land, but also that when we step into and accept, you know, the opportunity to self-educate about the legacy of the land that we're on and the overarching impacts of white supremacy and colonizer thinking in this conversation, we can see that you know, the two MASH people were having incredible impacts on, you know, the concentrations of carbon in the atmosphere by practicing prescribed burning, by tending, you know, the seedlings of oak trees. Oak is an incredible sequester of carbon from the atmosphere. They implemented a whole host of practices on this land, and that's true for indigenous peoples, not just even in the West, but all over the world, that there is a lot for us to learn. And I humbly have chosen to center decolonial thought at the center of my inquiry into this, and I invite anyone who's interested in really exploring regenerative living to explore what is out there on that front too.
Thank you for bringing that into the conversation, and I think it ties well in what, you know, you were saying a moment ago when you were going through the actual problems that, you know, they're overwhelming a bit. But the model that we've seen repeated throughout the earth is extractive from poor indigenous nations. You know, it, like, the lithium in all of our phones and computers is coming from a particular tribe that continues to, like, try to destroy the construction vehicles every time they come in there. There's hydroelectric dams being built in Brazil and other places, and I was reporting from Standing Rock three different trips, and had the pleasure of being tased five times by the Morton County Sheriffs on October 27th when they decided to come shut down our frontline camp and finally move everybody out. And I was there, and I sat and witnessed people being clubbed in the head, pepper sprayed, arrested, thrown to the ground, horse being tased, just, you know, trying to document at the same time as reacting and trying to, like, talk to them as, like, brother, why are you doing this? And push, just back and further. And I think, you know, another important element with the decolonization of this conversation and adding that, yes, like, we're on native land as well. And I say this as, I want to say this, that we're all indigenous to somewhere. It's important to remember that. And I say this as somebody who's indigenous to Texas, where I'm from, and the other side of my family is Seminole. And I've been learning more of my roots, and Standing Rock was a part of that. And I've been learning through the Choctaw, and I've specifically been tasked with the chief that I learned from, Chief Gray Eagle from Hugo, Oklahoma, the Choctaw people, to encourage more people of all colors, of all, you know, ethnicities, to learn their indigenous ways, to bring these ways back, because those are the ways that are close to the mother, and that if we reconnect to, we can solve a lot of these problems. And the other thing is, as far as Standing Rock as an example, and thinking long term about communities, is an aspect that we might not like to talk about often, but is going to be important as we move to this next phase, is the ability to defend our communities. Because if our communities have resources, the companies, what do? They hire, we now know that they had private contractors, military contractors coming in there, spying on people, and like I said, they just push. And it was probably one of the most heartbreaking experiences I ever felt, to have to walk away from that line. I kept coming back, I got pepper sprayed, kept coming back, got tased, they grabbed me, I got out of their hands, and after a while, it's just like, they just keep pushing until they had us far enough back, and it was very, you know, a defeating feeling to walk away from that. And I think long-term planning, community organization about how we protect ourselves and protect our resources is also necessary.
Yeah, good stuff. Yeah, thanks. I'm glad we're getting into some juicy stuff in this conversation. I feel a little passion coming on. It was really good. And I feel like we really got into, like, some core parts of our current climate, right? Which is so critically. The one thing that was kind of touched on by the two gentlemen is the regulatory climate. And so to call it by its name, like, that's something that we all are living with right now as we speak, the regulatory climate, right? And so even if we all as a group choose to be like, you know, let's just move to Bali or Chile, guess what, there's still going to be regulatory climate. And if anyone's a cannabis smoker, good luck, you know, getting it in to Bali. You know what I'm saying? It's like the regulatory climate is a foundational aspect of what we have to create relationship with, right? And so, you know, in permaculture, there's a saying that the problem is the solution, right? And so if a huge aspect of our current regulatory space has been created for the benefit and for the operational prowess of the corporation, right? And if assuming that organizational model is something that's an opportunity for us, I really feel that it's something we should strongly consider, right, as we come into these freedom cells, right, that really would like to have the ability to defend themselves and their resources, right? If we all have to hold a shield ourselves, that only gives us one arm to do the work we need to do, right? But if we can create an exoskeleton around ourselves in small functional groups, then we have a lot more efficiency, because with the same amount of resources, we won't have to spend so much time defending ourselves or living in fear of having to defend ourselves against essentially our regulatory space, right? And so the problem is the solution, and the corporate model is something that we should look towards to operate in the system that was built explicitly for that. And so also, as we have a de facto relationship, like, we're gonna need to use dollars for some portion of time. We're going to need to interact with our county, our state, and our federal government for some time. Those are de facto relationships that we have to have, and we can't just be like, oh no, I'm not talking to you. Like, that's not a solution, because they have power over us in that way. So we really need to meet them at the table, and it's a really important part of, you know, as we create, you know, go home and team up with the 5, 7, 10 people that we're closest with, you know, to create our dream lives in an efficient manner, we have to really address this regulatory space. Yeah, so that's my impassioned, you know, little opinion. How are we on time? It's 2:25. I'd love to touch on governance and make sure we get into governance. I'd also like to touch on distribution of yield. I'd also love to make sure we spend 15 minutes for questions at the end and any more impassionate evocation of language that comes. So I think that gives us 20 minutes. So I'd love to touch on governance. Happy to hear your guys' thoughts, especially you know, because, like, how much more anarchistic can we be than to, like, put on a corporate shell? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like,
I love my anarchist brothers and sisters, but I don't think we should be anarchistic. I think we should actually use what our Constitution has told us to do to actually direct our bureaucracies, which are, who knows what a definition of a bureaucracy is. Somebody raise their hand, tell me. You don't know. A definition of, yes? She said that bureaucracies have a certain system in their order relative to that. Actually, a bureaucracy, by definition of our Constitution, is an administrative body that is produced by our government to administer the laws of the people. That's what a bureaucracy is. Every regulatory agency, state, federal, or city, is that. It's an administrative body to run and administer the laws of the people. All right? So what we have to do is we have to, once we get those freedom cells going and they're all together and networked, we need to basically take over our bureaucracy by actually telling the bureaucracy what to do. So we at the Foundation of Life actually have a plan which talks about this very thing of utilizing your community and doing a specific set of operations that will get you in control of that bureaucracy. One is you should take those freedom cells, and you should demand from those bureaucracies your tax dollars. You should go there and apply for grants and ask for grants for 5 to 6 specific things, one of them being a school, one of them being a church, one of them being a healthcare system, one of them being farms, community farms, right? And other things which you are actually getting grants to build sustainably. Sustainable schools, sustainable farms, sustainable healthcare systems. And then we use that money, which we actually gave them for the administration of our communities, to actually build the sustainable systems that we need. So you build a school with sustainable buildings, sustainable water systems, sustainable air, air cleaning and air catchment systems, and you build all of those things. Then you return back to that same bureaucracy for the same tax dollars and ask for dollars to build housing for your families that are attending, where the students are being sent to those schools. And then we build with those tax dollars ourselves spaces where we live, which we call property spaces, right? Build those property spaces with the properties that we want, and then as communities that we've built all over the place, then tell the bureaucracies what, how we want them to be administered. All right, so that's basically, and we need to do this by our constitution as well. The constitution tells us there's two ways for the people to create laws and to direct its bureaucracy. One is by the legislatures that we elect. Guess what? That ain't happening, right? Because we know whose pockets they're in. They're not in ours, right? So that means that we only have the second option, which is a constitutional convention. And Wolfpack has talked about this and has been pushing this, and we should all look into what Wolfpack is talking about. A constitutional convention actually says that two-thirds of the state have to call a convention. So if we remember those cells that are locally and government political power take over our political states and local states, we can then make sure a constitutional convention happens. At that point, the bureaucracy is on hold, because the state's power, the power goes back to the states, so that the states meet to decide what they want to discuss. Because remember, there's 50 sovereign nations, even more based on treaties, but we know how that has happened, right? Nations that are actually in agreement called this thing called the Constitution. And at that point, the bureaucracy has to sit and wait, literally wait until we decide what they have to do. And then at what we do in that Constitutional Convention is tell them, bring to them the judicial system. This is how we want you to administer our judicial system, and stop incarcerating people for these things, and stop incarcerating people because of the color of their skin. This is what we want you to do in terms of legislatively, right? Stop taking money from all those big corporations and deciding things based on that money, right? This is what we want you to do with our education program, Betsy DeVos, wonderful person, right? And basically give them a certain amount of time. We will be in recess for 90 days. You have 90 days to correct the administration system to meet our demands, or we will disband you. The Constitution gives us that right. We have 50 sovereign nations. We don't need the federal government. We all have treasuries. We all have governors. We all have, and we can easily, with not a problem, make another agreement quickly to make sure we have intra-state commerce. So we really need to understand what our power is and the structure that is there for us to actually take back the power and actually become a part of that structure. And a way to do that is definitely by building these cells that we're talking about.
Thank you for that, brother. I know we're short on time. I'm going to try to follow that up. You know, the beauty of decentralized ideas is that they're decentralized and anybody can apply them in any way. Because me personally, I would never use freedom cells to try to attain political power or to use the political system. Also, I would say just, you know, because this is why I love diversity. And to me, in my perspective, the Constitution was written 200 years ago, and my ancestors, your ancestors, the women here, none of us were privy to that agreement. Nobody that I know living signed it. And also, I think morally, it's wrong for a group of people to come together and say, hey, we're going to write a piece of paper that dictates what everybody else on this geographical landmass has to live under. Like, it's silly. But yesterday, he was a part of a panel, because we're talking about regulatory institutions. He was a part of a panel on cryptocurrency, and one of the panel members talked about BitNation, and this is just one of many ideas where we could come to a future where people are literally able to create their own nations digitally, write their own constitutions, including environmental laws and norms of what they would allow. And you know, I'm just dropping that as there's many solutions. You know, and as far as talking about corporations, has anybody ever heard of B corporations, benefit corporations? I think it's a really cool idea. I've looked into it a bit and seen some that seem legitimate. Like they're actually legitimately serving the purpose and the mission that they put out to do. That's a good way to use that structure, you know, for what it is to be incorporated within the system. I think that for me personally, with the Freedom Cells idea, and I do want to emphasize that, call it whatever you want. When I first started promoting it, I was contacted by people all over the world who said, hey, we call it Hubs, we call it Circles, we don't have a name for it, you know, it doesn't matter, it's the concept. But for me, I complement that with a strategy of philosophy known as agorism, and I don't have the time to get into it now, but anybody who's interested, please do come talk to me. I have free copies of my book that goes into how Freedom Cells can be applied. But it's essentially about opting out of the system, not ignoring it and turning a blind eye, but instead of trying to fight them or spending energy, you know, voting or trying to go within those systems, as I said earlier, removing ourselves from the systems that we don't support. So you understand, you don't want to shop at Walmart, right? That's like purchasing power, using the power of your dollar. You don't want to shop at McDonald's and all these different things. The same idea for me is I don't want to shop at the government because they're bombing poor people in other countries. They're stealing, they're incarcerating all kinds of people. And we didn't give them the tax dollars. They took it, because I don't know if you guys ever tried not to pay it. They'll come take more money from you and they'll put you in a cage eventually. And whether you like what they're doing with it or not, you know, whether you know, some programs, maybe you say, I'm okay with my money going towards that. Maybe the war and the drone bombing and, you know, all the other things and building a police state, surveillance state infrastructure, you might say, no, I don't want to support that. In my ideal future, as we build these decentralized cells and we're addressing environmental issues, economic issues, all these different areas, it's up to us to build the new infrastructure to opt out of this system. And, you know, we're at the very, very, very early stages of this. Technology is, I was having a great conversation about this. Technology is moving so rapidly, but now are we going to be able to evolve and step up to the task? Because the technology is already abundant. There's so many solutions. We're all meeting each other here, trying to figure out how we can network and collaborate going forward. And that's an important step. But if we're not ready to step up to the plate, and you know, this may seem off topic, but to me, the whole root of this issue, why, you know, last week when I'm at home and I saw a guy throw a beer can out of his car right next to my house, why people are willing to do that and don't see the impact is because they're hurting inside. There's a lot of deep, deep healing that needs to take place within all of us. We all have doubts, fears, and insecurities that need to be addressed. And the suffering that we see in the mother is a reflection of what we see inside of each of us. So I think in addition to creating these new physical structures, we can't forget about the internal struggle, which is probably of utmost importance. Because I'll tell you, as somebody who tried to kill himself four different times as a teenager, was spent most of my 20s super depressed, got into drugs, drug addiction, went to prison. If you'd come to me with these problems at that point in time, I would have cared, I would have heard you, but I wouldn't have been able to do anything about it because I was just trying not to kill myself that day. I couldn't care enough about myself to care about the world. So if we don't empower each other and empower ourselves, people aren't going to see a reason to save for a better tomorrow, to think about the seventh generation, to think about who's coming after us. So I think that's important to note.
Wow, this is such a juicy conversation. I feel like we kind of left farming behind. That's cool. Yeah, it's a part of it. It's totally a part of it. I'm actually really glad we're talking more about this than just the specific practices. I wanted to add a couple pieces. I was reflecting in this conversation on a really important nuance that I'd like to call out particularly, which for me is this tension between, you know, removing ourselves from a system versus working within it for change. And to offer that, you know, different strategies are appropriate in different places. And there are so many different ways that, you know, that can manifest. There are certainly situations where, because of the distribution of people on a landscape, because of the distribution of water, the availability of water, the capacity of a landscape to support people, it may make the most sense, you know, all things averaged out, to be forming a closed, totally closed loop community, living totally off the grid. And, you know, I certainly think, especially in the world's dry lands, you know, places like Palm Springs, where we've created very concentrated human settlements, are probably not sustainable for the carrying capacity of the land when we look at the, you know, the limited quantities of abiotic resources like water. So I think that that strategy of being really closed loop is appropriate in some circumstances, but I also hesitate to offer that as a panacea. And I think, you know, sometimes it's really easy has felt easy for me at moments to say, oh gosh, well, I need to just live a completely, you know, carbon neutral lifestyle, sequestered away from all society. But, you know, by participating in our local economies, by participating in sharing economies, forging communities, actually choosing to not be 100% self-sufficient in terms of our food production, fiber production, you know, et cetera, health, radical healthcare, et cetera, you know, we're creating networks that are inherently resilient to stress, and there are certainly many communities and opportunities for us to scale up. You know, the transition town movement has been one particular container for that conversation in a really cool way, but I certainly don't think that we need to exclusively be living in closed utopian systems to be, you know, mitigating the impacts of everything we've discussed so far. The other thing I wanted to add is about setting the stage a little bit for the conversation around the regulatory climate in California and ways that we can intervene, you know, practically in the governance of our natural resources here for equitable and climate change mitigating impacts. Can you raise your hand if you're from California, if you live in California? Okay, cool, so mostly. How many people are in the kind of South Coast, Central Coast area? Yeah, wow, so most of us. So most of us are in basins, hydrologic basins, that have been overdrafted to some degree in terms of our extraction of groundwater versus the degree to which that groundwater has been, you know, naturally replenished on an annual basis. There's a new piece of policy in California called SGMA, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, which is coming into really coming into fruition in most basins right about now. Basically, if your governing water agencies have messed up the balance of extraction versus replenishment, they now are forced under this regulation to organize to make sure that that equation is relatively balanced, maybe not under the most ideal standards, because it has to be balanced, I think, according to 1990 levels, at which point, you know, we had already extracted a lot. But so the container for that implication is these groups called Groundwater Sustainability Agencies, GSAs, and most of us are in communities where those GSAs are either just being formed or have just recently formed within the last year or so and are now in the process of writing acts, or excuse me, not acts, but plans to determine how they're going to bring their basins into balance. It's been a really impactful piece of legislation in terms of, you know, changing the climate around groundwater usage in California, which is also linked intimately to, you know, on a more local scale or state scale, the extraction of resources away from communities of color and, you know, the depletion of natural resources in places that are already impacted by those overlapping lenses of oppression. So I urge everybody to check out whether or not you have a GSA and to show up. You can make public comment. And, you know, this is not this. Well, there was a recent proposal, not happening quite within that GSA, but related to water in our local area, in the Fillmore area, Santa Paula area. A fracking company wanted to dump their wastewater into the Santa Paula aquifer, and with 60 public comments alone, this huge multinational fracking company had their plan totally shot down, and that had, you know, major impacts in protecting the availability and quality of natural resources for a low-income community of color in our bioregion. That activism was facilitated by Los Padres Forest Watch, which is a great organization. I urge anyone in our immediate Santa Barbara, you know, Ventura, Central Coast area to check out. So, Yeah, definitely. Well, it's a complicated question. There is a lot of agriculture happening in California that is highly extractive of our natural resources, that is, you know, non-regenerative. Even organic agriculture and wine, like you mentioned, you know, those two industries. Organic is not enough is the really common theme of this conversation right now, that the standards to be organic in terms of how they're written governmentally are insufficient to actually protect us from the consequences of, you know, centralized agriculture. So we really need to transcend, you know, the limitations of those standards and demand, you know, in my perspective at that grassroots level, that regenerative practices that actually restore soil and mitigate, you know, groundwater depletion and return natural resource abundance to our communities, we have to demand that at, you know, a local level, because at a larger scale, you know, the standards are just insufficient and the languaging is inadequate. Resource commoning?
Yeah.
I'm not particular with that exact technique, but I think if what you're getting at is kind of like the reverse of the tragedy of the commons, that's also an important piece. Yeah, certainly when people have kind of just, I don't want to say disorganizedly, but have come together without, you know, creating common standards around how they want to use a common resource, the outcome has typically been depletion of that resource, a race to the bottom. So I would offer that, yeah, we definitely need to be organizing intentionally around the collective use of our common resources, because for sure when that happens without intentional, you know, setting of expectations and standards, the outcome is typically depletion. So did that touch on what you were asking about? Cool.
Thank you. We have one more question, and then I'll hold for a minute, and then we'll send it back to you. It's fun seeing everyone talk, and then the other three of us like just sitting there nodding our heads, and then all of you guys out there Yes, we got 15 minutes. I'm gonna add one more framework to the conversation, and we'll cycle back through for closing comments from each of you, and then we'll turn it over to questions. And maybe we'll start with you. Is that cool? Okay. Avery said, you know, I feel like we're getting away from farming, and for me, that's the whole point of it, is that we're not, right? Because the regulatory space, we need to provide the regulatory space a framework understanding for what it is we're doing and their language patterns, right? Because if we say, oh, we're a hippie village on the hill, and we don't use money, we don't pay taxes, and we shit in a bucket, like, then literally it can escalate to a response that Derek felt when he was at BlackRock. Like, who's seen the videos of like the raw milk producers, you know? Like, who had like FDA and like semi-automatic weapons show up to their dairies, right? This is real. Like, if we're not engaging in an open relationship with the regulatory space, in open dialogue, then we really put ourselves in a susceptible position, right? And so farming is really just what we call what we're doing, right? It's like, hey, we're farming here, and they say, oh, okay. And then we're like, yeah, we're complicit with this and this and the other. And similarly to what Dr. Life was saying, is that there's a tremendous amount of resources available to us once we call ourselves farms. Right, there's federal loan opportunities for, you know, land access is an issue here, you know, and you can get loans up to $1.3 million at like 3% interest in the name of a corporate entity as a farm, you know, as long as you're farming, right? And a lot of the things that our hippie village is cited as for being illegal magically becomes legal a lot of times with grant money available the minute we say, oh, we're farming, right? So farming is really just what we're calling what we're doing when we speak to the powers that be. And then the other point I'd like to share is, you know, as we go down this path of recreating our world, right, the seed of the seed is really what we're creating first, right? These seed elements. And as you know, within each seed is the DNA of the whole, right? So in these freedom cells, right, in what we call freedom cells, but, you know, when we go speak to the government, we're like, they're our farms, right? We can have the DNA of the entirety of our new civilization, right? Our new society, right? And so, I think something that we haven't quite touched on, and if someone has knowledge on it or would like to share it in their closing comments, that'd be great, is the governance model, right? Because as we act as a common body, right, I think it's important to step away from majority rule vote, which is a huge, huge fundamental, you know, reason for many of the problems that we see in our world, because what it enables, the majority to silence the voice of the minority, and the minority gets bitter and cuts at the ankles of the majority, and it's a recipe for disaster in what's seeming a very innocuous, like, oh, majority rule, we'll just all, like, put up our hands, and, like, if there's more of one of us, then we'll win, right? So there's alternative governance strategies that I think are really an important part of how we make choices for our, you know, freedom cells, which are farms, right? So that's one last piece to interject. And so, yeah, closing comments. I think we've got a few minutes for each of you, and then we'll take questions.
All right, let's see. In terms of governance, I am, one of the reasons I was on the cryptocurrency panel is because I am right now working on an algorithm for a Bruce coin, which is a festival community coin. And the part of that algorithm is talking about exactly how that coin base would be governed. So I am really into, I'm doing another talk on self-directed enterprise, community enterprise, and I'm really into cooperative self-direction, okay? So in order for actually any cooperative self-direction governance to work, it has to be based on three principles that the everyone who is a part of the membership base, whether it's a cell, whether it's a community, whether it's a farm director, whether it's a company, whatever, everyone has to have voice. And those voices, one vote voice, one vote if you want to say it, have to be voting on everything based on three principles. Whether it is equality, equal, equity, right? I'm talking about you get what you put in, you get back, the reward is relative to what you put in. And the last is need. At what level of need are we? So if we're talking about distribution of resources, as we talk about in social science, if we think about that, some things are possible to be equal, right? So, but not everything is possible to be equal. It depends on the amount of resource we have. It depends on what situation is happening at a given time. Like you just said, what happened in Houston at the point that everybody runs to the store, there is no possibility for equality because people are grabbing what they can get based on need, which is the third piece, right? Which is exactly. We need to decide, there are some things that we need and some things we don't. So the plan that I said earlier talks about a structure that says you need to have the systems built to give yourself the resources that you need first. So that's a priority over actually having the houses that families are going to have to live in without having resources. Because if you bring people all together and you don't have the ability to actually feed them and clothe them and quench their thirst, you're gonna end up with what happens in cities all the time in situations of emergency, right? So those three things are what the principles which any governance should be built upon. And everyone who's participating has the ability to aid in that. And in some situations, I personally argue that should be equal in terms of one voice, one vote, including our corporations. If we're going to keep a structure of corporations, if corporations are going to be equivalent to people, then guess what? They should only get one freaking vote, just like I do, right? Regardless of how much money or how many pieces of paper they have in their pocket, right? And they should be able to vote on equity, equality, and basis of need, just like we do. Right? So, yeah, no, sorry, CEO, you don't need to make 158 times more than your janitor. It's just not something that's needed. Yes, mothers may need more than single fathers like my, or excuse me, single males like myself who don't have children to tend to. Totally fine with that understanding, right? And we need to talk about that as a group when we're making decisions in any situation. So if we're having a farm, and we're using the farm model, if we think about that applicably, like the group that's farming has to decide what we need to, in terms of resources, to have our crop this year. We need to decide what crops we want, right? So need, do we really need string beans when we have a whole what do you call it, a silo of those things sitting over there, right? You know, so those are the three principles that, in terms of governance, I believe are really important to be the basis of any governing situation.
I think we're doing our closing comments, right? I really just want to say thank you guys for, you two guys for being on the panel and you for hosting it. I feel very humbled to be next to such brilliant people and to everybody in this room. And also, this is my first time to Lucidity and everybody's been very welcoming and kind, so I appreciate that. As far as governance goes, I'm very thankful that you said, this whole idea of majority rule, which, in case you don't know, that's known as democracy. It's a problem. The idea that people, you guys can say you get enough people and you go vote on something and you can force me to do something. I think that's immoral. I think it's wrong. Some people call it government, but I say it's force. It's institutionalized violence, and it's wrong. So when I imagine the future, I truly do imagine decentralized communities, decentralized governances. I'm not trying to create a new system that we can all live under, because I think that's the problem. I want to see you guys. I want to see him fight in the ways that he wants, maybe through the system or through different grants and all the strategies that we take, and see them all flourish so that we can get to that point. And then when we get to this open space, we can see what we want to live like. And everybody, there should be diversity, and there should be common norms, I think, that we could get to that establish and allow that, that flourishing to take place. But as far as governance goes, I'm not interested in, I have ideas that are contained within my books that I think, is sort of my vision and that could be adapted, but I don't want that to be the vision, the one next system that we aim for. I think if we're aiming for another centralized system, it's what they call revolution. It's revolving, it's going in circles. And every time that people have tried to seize the power because they thought they had the best vision for everybody else, they become the tyrants they fought, and things end badly. So I don't want to be the next tyrant. And I think, unfortunately, given time and place, each of us put into a position of power, we might act in a tyrannical way, given that we might come to think, hey, I do know what's better for other people. I do know what they should eat, what they should think, dress like, who they should have sex with, and all these sort of things. I don't think that's right, so I'm not after that. As far as closing, again, take the ideas of community organizing, find your local community farms and make it a hub, bring music there, bring food there, do the garden crawl. I would love to see other cities take the garden crawl idea, because people respond very well to it. It gives you an opportunity to take your activism, which we're all activists. You don't have to be on the street holding a sign to be an activist. It's a way of life. It's the conversations you have and the actions you take every day. So we can implement those subtle ideas, as well as, working within the system when necessary. And beautiful to hear, 60 comments can stop something so destructive, right? So there are times, when it might serve you. If you're going to work within the system, my advice is definitely focus locally, as local as you can get, because even on the local level, there's corruption. I've been laughed in the face at plenty of city council meetings and had them turn a blind eye and ear to all sorts of problems. So I always look for, when I see a problem, what is the solution that me as an individual in my community can take? And that's where I focus my energy. And I think that's where the most growth is actually going to happen. And I do hope you guys will check out the freedomcells.org website. And if you're interested in anything I mentioned, please do come talk to me. I have 5 free books for anybody who's interested in learning further about this, and a couple of shirts, and I would love to exchange info. Thank you, guys.
Cool, yeah, likewise. This has been a fun, exciting, juicy intersection for a lot of different pieces of this conversation. Two particular concepts that I'll throw in the pot as well to the conversation are, we talked about governance, and I also feel consensus-based decision-making is a huge part of the work we need to do. And I also have seen, through participating in consensus-based communities and engaging in, the governance on a household, community scale, from community being from 10 to, 100 voting people, that we have a lot of work to do on just educating ourselves about how to do that. It's not as easy as it looks. So I urge everyone to, be curious, stay curious, and stay humble about, what it actually looks like to transition into those types of democracy, or not democracy, governance. It's really a powerful way of implementing that permaculture principle of the redistribution of surplus, back into our communities, and it's a great tactic for redistributing power. The other piece of that, which is very linked to it, is that co-ops cooperative organizations, I think, are also a great way of impacting systems. They are, for me, at that nexus of, you know, operating in a cell that is kind of outside of the structures we don't want to participate in, while at the same time impacting those bigger structures. Especially, you know, co-op grocery stores are a great way of relocalizing power in our food systems. We have a great one in our community, the Isla Vista Food Co-op, which has been around for, gosh, like 45 years. For anyone who's not familiar with the co-op, it's really putting that kind of often consensus-based, you know, governance into practice. One vote, you know, one person or one member. Profit is redistributed to the membership.